In the shadowy corners of fantasy literature, few works captivate with the raw intensity of Queen of Roses. This dark fantasy romance has become something of a cult phenomenon, with readers across social media platforms creating elaborate fan theories about its complex protagonist, Morgan Pendragon. The book's exploration of suppressed identity resonates deeply with modern audiences, particularly among young adults navigating their own paths to self-discovery. What makes this tale particularly compelling is how it subverts traditional Arthurian legends, reimagining familiar characters through a feminist lens that challenges conventional power structures. Briar Bolin, the pen name of USA Today best-selling author Fenna Edgewood, crafts a world where magic and political intrigue collide in ways that feel both ancient and startlingly relevant to contemporary readers.
The story begins with a haunting childhood memory that shapes Morgan's entire existence. Hidden beneath her mother's four-poster bed, young Morgan witnesses her father, King Uther Pendragon, murder her mother in a drunken rage. This horrific event establishes the foundation of Morgan's world, one built on violence, deception, and the systematic suppression of truth. Morgan's fascination with Lorea of Anselm's Book of Beasties, Marvelous and Rare, reveals her early connection to the magical world her heritage belongs to. The illustrated creatures, Nixies with sharp green teeth, handsome furry Puckus, sinister Spriggans, represent a world beyond the human realm that simultaneously frightens and fascinates her. This duality mirrors Morgan's own complex identity as someone caught between two worlds. The murder scene itself is brutal in its simplicity. King Uther, drunk and enraged about being trapped in a political marriage, beats Morgan's mother until her head strikes the stone wall. The violence is made more disturbing by her mother's lack of resistance. She neither flees nor fights back, accepting her fate with a resignation that suggests this isn't the first time she's faced his wrath. When she falls lifeless to the floor, Uther immediately begins crafting a lie about an accident, knowing his position as king means no one will question him. This foundational trauma establishes the central tension of Morgan's existence. She lives in a world where power determines truth, where her own identity must remain hidden, and where her fey heritage, evident in her not-quite-human ears and prematurely gray hair, marks her as an outsider in the human court. The scene also introduces the pattern of female disposability that characterizes Camelot under male rule. Uther's three wives, Ugraine, Morgan's mother, Etard, executed for adultery, and Enid, who died in childbirth, are all ultimately sacrificed to maintain the patriarchal power structure of the kingdom. The Rose Court, with its imagery of beauty concealing thorns, becomes the perfect metaphor for this deceptive world where appearance and reality rarely align. The roses embroidered on courtiers' clothing and carved into the throne itself symbolize the superficial beauty that masks the court's underlying cruelty, a cruelty Morgan witnesses firsthand when her brother Arthur orders the execution of a young part fey boy for stealing an apple. Arthur's court operates as a well-oiled machine of oppression, particularly against those with fey heritage. The execution of the young boy with violet-tinged skin and blue hair represents not just an individual act of cruelty, but a systematic campaign against otherness that permeates the kingdom. The Great Hall itself embodies this oppressive system. With its vaulted ceilings and stone columns carved with carefully selected historical scenes, the space physically manifests the kingdom's selective memory, celebrating victories while erasing inconvenient truths. The tapestries that adorn the walls tell only the stories that reinforce the current power structure, much like how Morgan's own history has been rewritten to diminish her claim to the throne. Arthur's casual cruelty during the boy's execution reveals the depth of his sadism. When he escalates the charge from stealing an apple to spying for Regd, he demonstrates how easily power can manufacture truth.
The beheading that follows, with blood splattering the courtier's fine clothing, serves as a grotesque reminder of the violence that underlies Camelot's supposed civilization. Arthur's smile as he leaves the scene confirms that this display wasn't about justice, but about reinforcing his absolute authority through fear. The court's reaction is equally telling. While some gasp in horror, none dare speak against the king. Even Merlin, the high priestess who had suggested testing the boy for magical abilities, can only comfort the visibly shaken Prince Kay after the fact. This collective silence in the face of injustice illustrates how tyranny thrives on compliance, a theme that resonates throughout the story. Morgan's position in this system is particularly precarious. Despite being first in line to the throne by birthright, she has been passed over because of her mixed fey blood. Her father's decree that she would be dedicated to the Temple of the Three Sisters upon turning 21 effectively removes her from the line of succession while maintaining the appearance of honoring her royal status. She becomes an outcast in the Rose Court, her future decided before she was old enough to question it. This systematic marginalization extends beyond Morgan to other vulnerable groups. The food shortages in Camelot disproportionately affect the common people, creating growing unrest that Arthur chooses to ignore. His focus on military expansion and religious fundamentalism, particularly his growing interest in Perun, the male deity whose rituals all involved blood, points to a regime increasingly defined by violence rather than governance.
Perhaps the most insidious form of control in Morgan's life is the medicine she's been taking since childhood, a concoction that suppresses her fey nature and keeps her docile. This daily ritual represents the systematic suppression of her true identity, a literal poisoning disguised as care. The medicine's effects are comprehensive. It dulls her senses, causes persistent headaches, disrupts her sleep, and suppresses her appetite. Most significantly, it mutes the magical abilities inherent to her fey heritage and alters her appearance, turning what would be luminous silver hair into a dull gray that makes her appear prematurely aged. This physical transformation serves to further alienate her from both the court and her own sense of self. Morgan's relationship with the medicine reveals the internalized oppression she's developed over years of conditioning. She faithfully takes it every other night, believing it protects her from becoming something monstrous. Her fear isn't just of physical transformation, a tail or claws or horns, but of mental changes, particularly the bloodlust she believes characterizes the Fae. This fear, planted by those who benefit from keeping her powers suppressed, becomes a form of self-policing that requires no external enforcement. The medicine represents a broader societal pattern of forcing conformity through both physical and psychological means. Just as Morgan is made to suppress her fey nature, others in Camelot face similar pressures to conform to increasingly narrow definitions of acceptability. Galahad faces persecution for his sexual orientation under Arthur's new edicts declaring certain people impure and unfit to serve in the temple or army. Women like Lancelot fear they'll be next. Even Kai, the youngest prince, is being molded according to Arthur's harsh Perun-inspired values. When Morgan finally stops taking the medicine during her journey, the transformation is remarkable. Her appetite returns, her headaches vanish, and her hair develops a pearly silver sheen that reflects her true nature. More significantly, her dormant magical abilities begin to emerge, first in moments of extreme danger, then with increasing control as she embraces her heritage. This physical and magical awakening parallels her psychological liberation from the constraints that have defined her existence. The medicine's true purpose is revealed through its absence. It was never about protecting Morgan, but about protecting others from her power. As Lancelot pointedly asks, "Was your family protecting you or protecting themselves from you?" This question forces Morgan to confront the possibility that her supposed weakness was actually strength deliberately suppressed by those who feared it. Morgan's journey takes a perilous turn when she meets Vesper, a charming minstrel whose seductive music and apparent understanding of her fey nature offer a tempting alternative to the isolation she's always known. Their relationship illustrates the vulnerability that comes with awakening to one's true self, the danger of mistaking manipulation for genuine connection. Vesper embodies the archetype of the false savior. His beautiful music, which seems to speak directly to Morgan's soul, creates an artificial intimacy that bypasses her natural defenses. His physical beauty, amber curls and finely chiseled features, and apparent acceptance of her emerging fey nature make him irresistible to someone who has always been rejected for her difference. When he plays his lute with otherworldly skill, the music reaching into her soul, Morgan experiences a connection she's desperately craved. Their romantic encounters in the forest, where Morgan experiences physical pleasure for the first time, create a powerful bond that clouds her judgment. The intensity of these experiences, "I surrender to his touch as he explores my body with gentle expertise, bringing me to ecstasy against a tree," makes her vulnerable to manipulation. When Vesper cryptically warns that you might not be good for her, his acknowledgement that "everything wrong is" only adds to his dangerous allure. What Morgan doesn't recognize is how Vesper's seduction mirrors the larger patterns of manipulation she's experienced throughout her life. Just as her family used the medicine to control her, Vesper uses physical and emotional intimacy to gain her trust and ultimately betray her. His music, which affects her so profoundly, is revealed to be a form of magical manipulation, not unlike the medicine that suppressed her powers. The culmination of this false salvation comes when Vesper leads Morgan to the lake where Excalibur is hidden. In a grotesque perversion of intimacy, he cuts her wrist and pushes her into the water, sacrificing her to achieve his own ends. His betrayal is complete when he admits to working for Arthur all along, using Morgan to retrieve the sword while his sister is held hostage in Camelot. This betrayal forces Morgan to confront not just Vesper's deception, but her own willingness to be deceived. Her desire for connection and acceptance made her vulnerable to manipulation, just as Camelot's desire for stability makes it vulnerable to Arthur's increasingly tyrannical rule. In both cases, the promise of safety and belonging blinds people to the true nature of those they've trusted with power. Morgan's quest takes her through the Bloodlands, a desolate region that serves as both a physical landscape and a metaphorical representation of the broken world she inhabits. This journey through increasingly hostile territory mirrors her internal journey toward self-discovery and empowerment. The transition from Pendrath's cultivated landscapes to the untamed wilderness of Cerunos marks the beginning of Morgan's departure from the known world. The ancient stone road, clearly fey-made, that stretches through the forest represents the connection to her heritage that has always existed beneath the surface of her life. While Whitehorn reacts with disgust to this fey artifact, Morgan feels an inexplicable comfort in these ancient woods, suggesting her growing acceptance of her true nature. As they travel deeper into the wilderness, the landscape becomes increasingly alien and threatening. The Bloodlands themselves are characterized by twisted trees, hardened soil, and a decaying stench that creates an atmosphere of wrongness and decay. This external desolation reflects the corruption at the heart of Camelot, a kingdom that appears magnificent on the surface but is rotting from within. The dangers they encounter along the way, Fenrirs, harpies, and ultimately the undead fey children, represent the consequences of past conflicts and atrocities. The revelation that during the fey civil war, one faction unleashed a plague that killed all the children provides a haunting metaphor for how cycles of violence destroy the innocent and create lasting damage that persists long after the original combatants are gone. Mirrod Mion, with its massive chamber featuring soaring ceilings, skylights letting in the fading sunset, and tattered banners hanging from walls too high for humans to reach,
stands as a monument to a once great civilization destroyed by its own internal conflicts. The abandoned city embodies the potential fate of Camelot if Arthur's increasingly destructive reign continues unchecked. The most horrific manifestation of this broken world comes in the form of the undead Fae children who attack the group. Twisted, decayed creatures with wrinkled gray skin, festering eye sockets, and a gaping maw of jagged teeth. These beings, victims of a plague unleashed during a celebration, represent the ultimate perversion of innocence. Their attack forces Morgan to confront the reality that some damage cannot be undone, some wounds never heal, a harsh truth that applies equally to kingdoms and to individuals.
Throughout Morgan's journey, the concept of protection reveals itself as deeply ambiguous, often serving as a justification for control rather than a genuine act of care. This complexity is embodied in her relationship with Kairos Draven, whose role shifts from captor to protector to something far more profound. Initially presented as an intimidating royal guard, Draven's true nature unfolds gradually throughout the narrative. His early interactions with Morgan are marked by antagonism and mutual suspicion. When he discovers her injuries from Florian's abuse, his cold fury suggests a capacity for violence that both frightens and intrigues her. His insistence that she reveal who hurt her appears controlling rather than caring, yet his genuine concern distinguishes him from those who have previously claimed to protect her while actually causing harm. The power dynamic between them shifts during their journey. When Whitehorn attempts to kidnap Morgan, Draven fights to protect her despite his own injuries. Later, when the undead Fae children attack, he makes the difficult choice to protect the child Odelna while Lancelot is dragged away, a decision that reveals both his moral complexity and his capacity for making impossible choices in moments of crisis. Draven's relationship with the Exmoor Battlecat further complicates his character. The magnificent creature, supposedly extinct and known for its ferocity, responds to him with affection, purring deeply as he strokes its fur. This connection to a powerful wild being suggests that Draven himself exists outside conventional categories, neither fully human nor entirely other. The true nature of Draven's protection is revealed in the final scenes, when he arrives to find Morgan mortally wounded after her confrontation with Vesper. His desperate plea to the ancient being inhabiting Odelna's body, "Help her, please," reveals the depth of his attachment. The subsequent blood ritual, which reveals Draven's true Ciabra nature, complete with horns and golden claws, transforms their relationship from protector and protected to something far more profound and equal, a bond that transcends conventional power dynamics. This evolution reflects the larger theme that true protection cannot exist without equality and mutual respect. The protection offered by Camelot to its citizens, by Arthur to his siblings, by Vesper to Morgan, all ultimately reveal themselves as forms of control rather than care. Only when Morgan embraces her own power and Draven reveals his true nature can they form a bond based on mutual strength rather than dominance and submission. Morgan's journey from suppression to empowerment forms the emotional core of the narrative. Her gradual awakening to her true nature, both physically and magically, represents a profound reclamation of identity after years of forced conformity. The first hints of Morgan's dormant power emerge in moments of extreme danger. When crossbow bolts shatter the window at the Noble Knight Inn, she experiences a rush of adrenaline instead of weakness. The room hums with vibrant power, centered on her as heat fills her palms and flames erupt from them, engulfing the bolt mid-air and returning it with greater force to pierce her attacker's chest. This instinctive manifestation of power suggests that her abilities have always been present, merely waiting for the right circumstances to emerge. As Morgan continues her journey without the suppressive medicine, subtle changes begin to appear.
Her hair develops a distinct silver tone where it was once dull gray, with a pearly silver sheen that reflects her true heritage. Her senses sharpen, her appetite returns, and the persistent headaches that plagued her throughout her life begin to fade. These physical transformations parallel her psychological evolution as she gradually sheds the limitations imposed by years of conditioning. The Korraval Festival represents another significant step in Morgan's awakening. Her unusual susceptibility to the intoxicating Korva beverage reveals how her body is becoming more responsive to the world around her. When the handsome lute player calls her into the dancing throng, she experiences sensations previously unknown to her, tingling breasts, heat between my legs, suggesting that her emotional and physical suppression are intertwined aspects of the same control mechanism. Morgan's final confrontation with Vesper marks the complete emergence of her power. When he stabs her and prepares to ambush Draven, Morgan refuses to remain a victim. Drawing on my dormant power that I've denied for so long, she summons a burst of magical energy that slams Vesper against a pillar. In the face of his continued aggression, she unleashes her full potential. As he attempts to attack me, my magic surges forth with devastating force, reducing him to ash. This moment of terrible power represents not just self-defense, but self-reclamation, a refusal to continue denying her true nature. The price of this awakening is high. Mortally wounded by Vesper's betrayal, Morgan lies dying on the cold stone as Orcades claims Excalibur with satisfaction. Yet even in this moment of apparent defeat, Morgan has achieved a form of victory by finally embracing her authentic self. Her regret is not that she accessed her power, but that she hadn't trusted Draven instead of Vesper, suggesting her journey towards self-knowledge remains incomplete even as her magical abilities reach their peak. The climactic blood ritual between Morgan and Draven represents the culmination of their parallel journeys toward authenticity, their bond forged through shared danger, mutual protection, and gradual trust transcends conventional relationships to become something both ancient and transformative. Throughout their journey, Morgan and Draven develop a complex connection that defies easy categorization. Despite their initial antagonism, moments of unexpected tenderness emerge. Draven's gentle cleaning of Morgan's wounds, his protection during attacks, his refusal to abandon the child Odelna despite the danger she might represent. These actions reveal a capacity for care that contradicts his reputation as a ruthless killer. Morgan's feelings toward Draven evolve from fear to grudging respect to something more profound. Even as she pursues a physical relationship with Vesper, she remains aware of Draven's presence, his disapproving glances, his tactical withdrawals when Vesper plays music, his persistent concern for her well-being. When she wakes to find herself in Draven's arms after her fever, she acknowledges his physical appeal and the comfort she finds in his embrace, suggesting an underlying attraction that transcends their ostensible roles as princess and guard. The revelation of Draven's true nature, a Syabra with horns and golden claws, explains the connection he shares with the Exmoor Battle Cat and his supernatural abilities in combat. Like Morgan, he has been hiding his true self, though for different reasons. This parallel experience of concealment creates a foundation for genuine understanding between them that neither could achieve with others who haven't experienced similar alienation. The blood ritual that binds them represents a mutual surrender of autonomy in service of something greater. Draven's desperate plea to save Morgan reveals the depth of his attachment, while his willingness to reveal his true form demonstrates a trust previously unextended to anyone. The ritual itself, with its exchange of blood and formation of an unbreakable bond, suggests a connection that transcends conventional categories of relationship to become something both primal and sacred. Draven's declaration, "She is mine," as he carries Morgan away, might initially seem possessive, but in the context of their journey, it represents a mutual claiming rather than ownership. Having both been treated as disposable by those in power, they create a bond based on choice rather than obligation, on mutual recognition rather than dominance. This transformation through connection offers a counterpoint to the isolation that has defined both their lives, suggesting that true power emerges not from control, but from authentic relationship. Excalibur, variously called the Blade of Perun, Vela's Blade, or simply the Sword, serves as both literal object and potent symbol throughout the narrative. Its acquisition drives the plot, but its true significance lies in what it represents, the double-edged nature of power itself. The legends surrounding the sword reveal its ambiguous nature. Draven explains that it was forged by the goddess Zoria and her siblings as one of three especially powerful items created for the races of the world. When Perun raised the sword against his sister Divina, it split the heavens, allowing dark creatures to enter our world. This origin story establishes the sword as an instrument of both creation and destruction, capable of either protecting or devastating, depending on who wields it. Arthur's desire for the sword reveals his understanding of its symbolic importance. By possessing Excalibur, he would legitimize his increasingly tyrannical rule through connection to ancient power. His willingness to sacrifice his sister to retrieve it, sending her on a perilous journey with minimal protection, demonstrates his prioritization of power over family bonds, a pattern established by their father Uther. Morgan's conflicted feelings about the sword mirror her ambivalence about her own emerging power. She never wanted to seek this sword, yet recognizes that if Pendrath is truly at war and Arthur has turned against his allies, some form of counterbalance might be necessary. Her question, "How would bringing back the sword help if we'd only need to keep it from Arthur?" reveals her growing understanding that power itself is neutral. Its effect depends entirely on who controls it and to what end. The sword's location, embedded in stone beneath a misty lake, emphasizes its liminality. It exists between worlds, accessible only to someone with mixed heritage like Morgan. This positioning suggests the true power emerges from the integration of seemingly opposing forces rather than the dominance of one over another. When Morgan finally retrieves the sword, the consequences are immediate and unexpected. Rather than gaining control of this powerful artifact, she inadvertently frees Orchides, daughter of High King Gorlois, who claims the sword with satisfaction before disappearing. This twist reveals the fundamental truth about power that both Arthur and Morgan must learn. It cannot be possessed without consequence, and those who seek it often become instruments of forces beyond their comprehension. The sword's journey from divine creation to instrument of civil war to object of quest parallels Morgan's own transformation, from suppressed princess to awakened power. Both contain the potential for creation or destruction, protection or devastation. The key difference lies in self-awareness. Unlike the sword, Morgan has agency to choose how her power will be expressed in the world. As Morgan's journey reaches its climax, a profound truth emerges. Awakening to one's true nature is irreversible. Once she has glimpsed her authentic self and tasted genuine power, there can be no return to the comfortable ignorance of her previous existence. This truth manifests physically in Morgan's transformation. Her hair, once dull gray from the suppressive medicine, develops a luminous silver sheen that reflects her fey heritage. Her senses sharpen, her magical abilities emerge, and her very presence begins to affect the world around her in ways both subtle and dramatic. These changes cannot be undone. They represent not an alteration, but a revelation of what was always present beneath the surface. The psychological transformation is equally permanent. Having witnessed Arthur's cruelty, experienced Vesper's betrayal, and discovered her own capacity for both destruction and protection, Morgan can never return to her previous understanding of herself or her world. The comfortable narratives that once structured her existence, that the medicine protected her from becoming monstrous, that her dedication to the temple represented her best possible future, that her family acted in her best interest, have been irrevocably shattered. This irreversibility extends to the broader world as well. The revelation that Arthur has invaded Lyonesse, imposed martial law, and demanded blood sacrifices to Perrin represents a point of no return for Camelot. The kingdom cannot simply revert to its previous state. The damage done by Arthur's reign will require not restoration, but transformation, a new order built on different principles than those that enabled his rise to power. Even relationships cannot return to their previous forms after truth has emerged. Morgan's bond with Draven, forged through shared danger and mutual revelation, transforms both of them in ways that make their previous roles, princess and guard, captive and captor, impossible to maintain. Their blood ritual creates an unbreakable bond that represents not just a new relationship, but new identities for both. The final scene, with Draven carrying Morgan away after their ritual bonding, suggests not an ending but a beginning, a step into uncharted territory where old rules and expectations no longer apply. This forward movement, despite its uncertainties and dangers, represents the only possible path after awakening. Like the sword that cannot be returned to the stone once drawn, Morgan's true nature cannot be re-suppressed once revealed. This truth carries both liberation and responsibility. Freedom from false constraints brings with it the burden of choice, the necessity of determining how newly recognized power will be used in a world that remains hostile to difference. Morgan's journey from suppression to awakening is complete, but her journey toward purposeful use of her power is just beginning.